Spring is in the air, and it's time for the local farmers markets. Welcome to Delmarva Day. This is Don Rush. There are farmers markets up and down the peninsula, from Lewis and Rehoboth Beach to Ocean City and Salisbury and beyond. And they generate millions of dollars and attract several million customers. While there's little chance that they will replace the giant retail stores with the rows of standard prints, these outlets do provide for a more intimate consumer experience. To take a look at their growth in the region, we have in our studio this morning Bob Miller. He's owner and operator of Nice Farms Creamery in Federalsburg. Also Linda Blades, owner and grower of Blades Orchard and Faulkner Branch Cidery, also in Federalsburg. Lisa Garfield, owner of Calliope Farm in Salisbury. That's a small organic vegetable farm. And Gretchen Hansen, Rehoboth Beach, former restaurateur, now chef, blogger, freelance writer who encourages people to, in her words, live a joyful life from scratch. And welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Gretchen, I'm going to start with you. Sure. How significant is the growth of what you've seen in terms of these farmers markets?
Well, Don, I don't know if you read my article in Edible Delmarva for the spring edition, but we talked about how the farmers markets have just blossomed over the last 15 years. And it's grown from about 2 to about 20 farmers markets in the Sussex County area. And that's Sussex County of Delaware. What I found initially when the first farmers market opened in Rehoboth, and the only farmers market in Rehoboth opened, I found that it was an intricate way to really be part of the community. I was both a producer and a buyer. As a chef and a restaurateur, I bought my produce at the farmers market, made connections with the farmers, and then had them delivered to my restaurant. So most of my cuisine was farm to table. That being said, it's a really hard life as a chef and as a farmer to get the food to the farmers markets, and then also to be chopped down by the large box grocery stores as the profit margins get less and less and less. So as the farmers markets are growing, as people are also getting turned on to the farmers markets and shopping more at them, it also seems as if the profit margins are slowing down.
In fact, I think it was a survey by the Maryland Department of Agriculture who said something, local markets, farmer markets generate something like $51 million, I think, in sales, I think at least for 2015. In Delaware, best year, I guess, 2017 so far, $3 million in sales, 21 community-run retail sites. As you mentioned, there are the ones in Sussex as well.
Right.
What explains this explosion, particularly for people who are interested in moving beyond just simply the grocery store?
So I think there was, in 2009, 2010, there was a huge explosion of understanding about the farm-to-table chain. So how your food got to you became very important. Michael Pollan was instrumental in this and writing his books about how food got to us. So people became aware of shipping food great distances, the carbon footprint that would leave, but also, more importantly, they wanted that interconnection with the farmers in their own community. And I felt that in Rehoboth, where the farmers that I bought from in the farmers market, their kids were in kindergarten with my kids. They came and ate in my restaurant. There was this absolutely intimate community connection that was so important and could not be replicated in any other way. So the farmers markets became essential to the life of the community. It really became part of the community. It was heart of the community. And so for me, that was really important to be a part of. And I feel like people are getting turned on to that, and they understand the value of food because they're speaking to the producers that are producing it, the real people behind the scenes who are doing the hard work.
Lisa Garfield, I'm going to turn to you. The Calliope Farm here in Salisbury. How did you become involved with the farmers markets, and how? What kind of benefit do they provide for you, do you think?
Well, I became a grower. I grew up in cities, and I had no agricultural background. So I guess I see myself as part of the Back to the Land Part 2 that started about 12, 13, maybe 15 years ago. And I came at it from a nutritional standpoint to begin with and from a desire to know how to grow my own food. I think that farms now provide a lot of ecological services. They're taking care of the soil, they're preserving open spaces, and the food is just healthier. It's fresher, and there's a lot more variety. They're growing varieties that probably have more nutritional value, and they're getting it to people faster. So from a plant science standpoint, a lot of the components in plants that provide us with nutrients are part of the plant's own immune system. So plants grown in a more sustainable way actually have greater defenses, which then provide us with more nutrients like anthocyanins.
What's the process for you in terms of getting your product to, say, a farmer's market? How complicated is that as opposed to if you were like just, you know, growing it for the wholesaler?
It is very labor intensive. You have to harvest in all kinds of weather. You can't delay because you need to harvest things at their peak of harvest. You're loading up things. You're basically setting up shop multiple times per week. So it is very, very labor intensive. But having that direct contact with your consumers is so valuable. It's really what kind of keeps you going, drives you to keep doing it.
Linda Blades, owner and grower of Blades Orchard and Faulkner Branch Cidery in Federalsburg. You're obviously, how did you get involved in terms of getting your stuff to the farmer's market?
Well, 10 years ago, my husband and I had no experience in farming. We grew up in city, and he announced that he wanted to be a farmer. And so we went out and bought a fruit farm, and we were a little surprised to find out it's considered specialty fruit or specialty food.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little different looked at by banks, for one, and by insurance. And being in it for 10 years, I'll say, yeah, it's pretty special because it has a high risk to it. Because fruit is so susceptible. On a day like today, we'll find a time to get out there. Between raindrops, it's strawberry season. We went out yesterday. You know, you just do it. So we got involved because my husband was interested in farming. But we started right away with a few farmers markets that were pointed out to us and found the people are just as loyal. They're wonderful. On a day like today, we'd be open in Salisbury if it were Tuesday.
Right.
We'd be open and people would be there because they're that loyal to come to the farmer's market.
How, as I said, how complicated is it to get from your place to the farmer's market? Because you got to sell it all, set it up, as opposed to just having somebody come in and say, hey, take it.
Yes. You know, it comes down to how your presentation is when you get there, how many tables you set up, how many tents you set up. We all bring pretty big rigs. We set up and we want you to feel like you're walking into a little boutique store and people look for it. And so we harvest in the morning. We get everything loaded up on a big box truck with our tents and all our food and everything. It takes at least an hour to set up before market. And we're a little faster on the end. It takes about a half hour to break down. So,
hopefully you've sold everything. So it's easier, right?
And, man, do you pray for that so you don't have to put that weight away.
Right.
But it's a lot of work. But in between are the hours that you get to meet the people that are going to eat your food tonight.
Right.
And it feels good. It's nice.
And Bill Miller, you're owner and operator of Nice Farms Creamery in Federalsburg. How did you get involved in all of this?
Well, unlike a lot of everyone else here, I mean, we had a dairy tradition in my family, so we have been dairying before I was born, and even before my parents were born. There's dairying up in Vermont and also in New Jersey. So what was new with our aspect was the actually processing the milk on the dairy farm itself, and that was the quantum leap with our operation. That and also the grass-based dairy operation that we do. We don't confine the cows. We actually use intensive rotating grass grazing procedures at the dairy farm. So, and that's a little different in as well. So you got those two aspects that have changed it.
And in terms of like getting it to market, and I mean, how is that different? Have you had experience of doing the wholesale thing, or have you always done that?
We do a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're very heavily regulated, so I mean, you know, it's very challenging to just even open up a particular, you know, just a dairy farm is regulated, and then when you do the milk processing piece, I mean, we have federal and state oversight. And then if we do like the ice cream stuff, then you run into county stuff too. So that's probably one of our biggest hurdles is just being able to operate, which can be quite challenging. But then, you know, milk is very heavy. Every gallon weighs 8.6 pounds. So you got to keep it cold while you're at market. But I would like to echo what everyone else has said. I mean, without the support of the people of Salisbury in particular and all the other farmers market areas that we do, it wouldn't happen. It wouldn't happen. So we're very grateful for that.
So what time do you get up in the morning?
Well, today, 4 o'clock, I was making butter. You know, I'm here and then, of course, I'll be doing deliveries in town to Ocean City. And then I'm going to come back and make yogurt. You know, so it's a long day. I mean, 18 hours every day.
And by the way, do you sell anything to wholesale or are you strictly?
We do a little bit of both. I mean, you know, farmers markets are key. You know, I mean, we were talking earlier with Gretchen, right. You know, they're the mom and pop independent grocers are going away very quickly. And even the stores that are replacing them in these towns, you know, they might say local on the packaging or whatever. And I'm sure some of it is, but, you know, they pick and choose who they want to work with. And an operation like mine, they want 10 or 15 locations. It's very difficult to be able to do that. But fortunately.
Yeah, I want to touch on that because that's actually really important. Bob right. And I were talking about this before we started today. And I was price comparing a couple of gallons of milk in Baltimore City. And I looked at milk in a sort of one area, it was $1.89, another area, it was $2.19. Not looking at the socio-political reasons that milk was such different prices, there's no way that a farmer that does that kind of intensive labor can actually produce milk for that cost. So what's happening is these large box stores are getting subsidized products, and those subsidized products are their loss leaders. So people are coming in and buying their milk and then buying their other things with the loss leaders. But for an independent farmer like Bob here, that's not even a profit. He can't even make that for a profit.
Absolutely.
So that's why farmers markets are so important, is that we keep these farmers in business. And one of the things I want to go back to with you two is that over the last 12, 15 years, that volume of independent growers has changed what's being produced. Like, you're producing organic vegetables. It used to be you could get carrots and, you know, five other things. Now there's 30, 40 different kinds of just greens and 8 types of kale. You can't get those in grocery stores. Grocery stores, if you're lucky, you get 2 types of kale, 3 types of lettuce.
Right.
Getting back to, you know, there are risks. I mean, you know, people, you know, I like doing a balanced approach for sure. But, I mean, certainly there are some that, I have an article here from the New Food Economy. This is from just recently, 8 March 2018. And it's a dairy farm operation that got in bed with Whole Foods. It's what it is.
Okay, Whole Foods, yeah.
And, as it says in the article, Whole Foods turned out to be both a generous patron and a cruel master. And this guy ultimately went out of business after 9 years. So he went from just starting, partnering with Whole Foods, growing his business, and then with a lot of the stuff happening with Whole Foods now, slammed the door. Now his $12,000 facility, his 32 employees, empty, off, you know, out of work, and then also he's millions of dollars in debt. So that's, you got to be very careful, and that's why going back to the farmers market, you know, that really gives us probably our best weapon now is farmers markets to directly market our stuff safely.
Yeah.
How much of your product production is sold at a farmer's market as opposed to, say, the retail or the wholesale?
Ooh, we are probably, you know, at a 60-40 with 60% definitely going at farmer's markets, 40% change. You know, our milk production fluctuates because, you know, grazing cows do not give a consistent amount of milk. And certainly some markets do close. So it's, you know, but you have to have a balanced approach for sure. Got to have a balanced approach and good people willing to work with you.
What about Melinda? What about the idea that have you dealt with wholesalers, or are you strictly? What is that experience like? And what do you look for to make sure that you don't get what happened to this person with the Whole Foods?
Well, it was a surprise to us when we got into it that in farming, except for milk, I think they come to you. Your wholesale customers come to the farm and pick it up. And so the stores that require us to deliver to them make it very difficult, and we tend to shy away from that. But we find large produce stands, we find some independent stores, and they work with us. And they're all local here on Delmarva, so that we can do, I would say it's close to what Bob is mentioning, a 60-40 mix. We primarily wholesale peaches. So it's, you know, not all of our crops, but I don't think without wholesale we would do as well as we have. They're very important to us. But I also see people come to the farmer's market and they may complain once that something is a little more pricey than a store they go to. They come back again and again because the food, because it's fresher, tastes better. Quality. And because we pick it at the right time, it tastes better.
Right.
You know, it's fantastic to watch someone come back and compliment your product. You know, nothing gets better than that.
Lisa, what about you? What's your situation with wholesalers?
I did somewhere, I guess it would be, I sold to restaurants quite a bit, and I also operated a community-supported agriculture program and a restaurant-supported agriculture, so similar to a CSA, but for restaurants. And that would be somewhere more in between retail and wholesale, maybe kind of that midway point. And that was really necessary and valuable for my system to be economically viable. I needed a certain amount of guaranteed outlet that didn't rely on farmers markets and, you know, the wavering attendance depending on weather, things like that. So I think ultimately in building up like a regional or local food system, you need all of these elements. You need options.
Gretchen, so how significant is this in terms of there was a suggestion that there'd be some kind of certified Delmarva grown label of some kind. I know there's some talk about that. Is that, how far along is that? Is that a possibility, do you think?
Well, I covered this in an article I wrote recently about even in farm country, farm to table is hard, right? And so it's very, very difficult to get restaurants to actually buy the products they say they're buying because it's inconvenient for them. And that's where Chesapeake Harvest has stepped in, bridged that gap. We tried doing this about 8 years ago with, it was called Local on the Menu, where people had to buy just three items locally, and they could get a sticker on their door that said Local on the Menu. And it was almost impossible to get them to consistently buy those three items because of the lack of a delivery system. Because, like you're saying, it's if you have to deliver, that's almost impossible. I can't leave my restaurant during the summer. There's no way. You can't leave your farm during the summer. There's no way. How do we get that between point to point? So now we're working on new systems that get product from your farm to restaurants and from your farm to other places. And so that would be awesome if we could get it done. It is hard to get that kind of sustainability of a system.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
So I'm on the board of the Delmarva Farmers Union, which is a local grassroots organization. And we are actually about to launch a certified Delmarva grown initiative. So, you know, people can know it's a third party certification that farms can adopt to be a part of.
Didn't they just publish that in the Delmarva Farmer, I believe, right?
It's been in, I think, Edible Delmarva.
Right.
And we also have been holding workshops about forming things like growers cooperatives that can facilitate easier ordering for restaurants.
One of the experiences we had with Local on the Menu is people would say that they were buying local produce, and they actually weren't.
Yeah.
So that's a real common problem. And, it is hard, there's no question, but you have to have some sort of system in place that confirms that people are actually buying the local product before they can claim they're buying the local product.
And is this sort of a seal of approval? Is this something that is designed to be, say, placed on restaurant menus, or is this has
some
greater
labels,
application?
Isn't it?
I mean, what...
Actually, farmers markets, who are producer-only markets, can also be certified, as can businesses, restaurants. There's a variety of guidelines depending on the type of business, but you have to be very committed to carrying a high percentage of local foods.
Right.
If you're a value-added producer, you have to be using local foods in that product. And it's a simple certification process. You can actually be certified by another farmer or by an extension agent, by a farmer's market manager, but that person will come and look at your operation and make sure that you have the capacity to grow the things you say that you're growing. And yeah, so customers are insured that when someone is saying they're local that right. that they are.
So does is it? So you owned a restaurant, Gretchen. So is this? I mean, is this something that, that restaurants would necessarily want? I mean, are they seeking it out, or is it
Absolutely.
Something that, or is it something that, that somebody's showing up and sort of pitching to them?
So both.
Okay.
Somebody like me, like I was passionate about farm to table.
Right.
That was everything to me. Was buying locally, produce and putting it on my menu. And because I was a chef owner, I had the ability to flex my menu every day. So say, for example, I would buy heirloom tomatoes from you one day, and I would say heirloom tomatoes from Calliope Farms in this salad, and then next day I would buy it from, say, Pfeiffer's, and I'd say heirloom tomatoes from Pfeiffer Farms on this menu. So I could say where those tomatoes were bought. The issue is, again, making sure that that's actually what's happening, making sure that it is your tomato or his milk or, you know, your peaches that are actually being used on the menu. And so there has to be some sort of follow through with that. You have to, with restaurants, you have to stay on top of it because during the summer people get busy and they don't do what they say they're going to do. They call Keeney at midnight and order their produce from Keeney because, oh my God, they just ran out of tomatoes and they didn't realize that. And I did it too. I mean, I'm not saying that I was perfect in any stretch of the imagination because there was a Saturday night that if you went through five cases of tomatoes, you needed tomatoes on Sunday. You couldn't get through Sunday without tomatoes.
Right.
So.
And I guess there's also some talk about, there was reading something about the rabbit hole, I think. To tell me a little bit about that. I thought I saw your name, Bob, mentioned too,
in
connection with it. So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, you know, they are, as I understand, an up-and-coming thing here in town. It sounds like they're a farm to like a restaurant type of thing that's been developing. I mean, we initially worked with them for sure, and I think they're still trying to get their legs under them.
Right.
You know, I know downtown here in Salisbury, there's been a lot of construction and stuff, and that may have, you know, kind of set them back a tad. But as far as I know, I mean, they're still doing their thing. And yeah, we did have sold them some product in the past.
Hmm. So, Gretchen, how significant in terms of the economic impact of these kinds of farmers markets? I mean, for instance, in Salisbury, you know, you can go by where they are, I guess, and you see a lot of activity. But is there some spillover from this economic activity, you think?
So, for Delaware, almost 70% of our land is agricultural land. I think it's 60 point something. I can't really remember exactly.
That's changing, sadly.
It's changing, sadly. And it's going down every day. However, of that, most of it is poultry. And of the poultry, most of it goes to this country.
Right.
And only a very, very small percentage of poultry actually makes it to a farmer's market. So if you look at the overall impact of that, that doesn't seem significant. What you need to look at is the microcosm of the impact. So Your family. Those families all make up a community. And so that community-run agriculture, that CSA, that restaurant-sponsored agriculture, that is integral to the life of a community, to the life of the small town, to the life of Main Street. And if we all want to shop at Walmart, that's what we can do. But we're going to lose something that's integrally valuable to our communities, which is the ability to sit at a roundtable discussion and meet people and talk to people and have a commonality. And that's what a farmer's market gives you.
Yeah, it's a source of pride, uniqueness. I mean,
Absolutely.
Salisbury is unique. Lewis, Delaware is unique. And that's pride and that's an attraction for visitors, too. I mean, it just makes you special.
Well, we're speaking with Bob Miller. He's owner and operator of Nice Farms Creamery in Federalsburg. Also, Linda Blades, owner and grower of Blades Orchard and Faulkner Branch Cidery, also in Federalsburg. Also, Lisa Garfield, owner of Calliope Farm in Salisbury, a small organic vegetable farm, and of course, Gretchen Hansen, a former Rehoboth Beach restaurateur, also chef, blogger, freelance writer, and again, she encourages people to live a joyful life from scratch. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. For a historic summit between President Donald Trump and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, but will it happen? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. With Singapore as a site for the historic meeting, this week North Korea may have upended the president's plans. North Korea threatened to nix the summit plans, calling off a meeting with South Korean leaders as the joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises get underway. In addition, word came from North Korean officials that they are opposed to demands that their country get rid of nuclear weapons unilaterally. At our studio this morning to take a look at where we are as the summit date approaches, Tehan Anam, he's the associate professor with political science department here at Salisbury University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So what do you make of this latest flurry of activity here with everything seemed to be going smoothly, lots of praise from Donald Trump for Kim, and then suddenly we get this hiccup. What do you make of it?
It's funny that this hiccup happened because just a couple of days ago I gave a lecture. In that, I gave really optimistic, but even though I emphasized the very cautious optimistic view on what will happen. But I was not really surprised by today's development, given what we went through over the last, let's just say, 60 years, right? There have been up and downs repeatedly, and so I was not really surprised, and if you think about what North Korea really wants, what they have, compare that to the demand made by some of the officials, not all of them, in the White House, there's a big gap. So it is, I think, only natural, like any other negotiation, that North Korea will demonstrate, will show their hands, right? Show what they have, what they can do to, well, come to some sort of more agreeable consensus. I think that's sort of only natural to expect to see things like this. Probably more, very likely, right? Well, possibly more, I should say. Given the high stake and pressure that these countries, especially North Korea, is feeling at this moment.
Let me ask you this in terms of the uproar. The first initial statements by North Korea seem to be directed at the military, joint military exercises, things that have been planned for a long time. Certainly, the administration did not expect any kind of pushback. And then they canceled, of course, the North Koreans, their meetings with the South Koreans. How much, just going that far, how much was that a reaction to the military exercises? Or do you think the military exercises were just simply a way to, say, threaten the summit? I mean, what do you make of that particular element?
I think it's a more closer to the latter. In other words, the joint military exercise didn't really play maybe a little role, but virtually nothing, because they just canceled the meeting, the high-ranking official meeting between North Korea and South Korea. But they made a proposal of the meeting about 15 hours before they canceled it. Before they canceled the meeting, when they made a proposal, the military exercise was already underway. So it doesn't really add up to say that we are canceling it because we didn't like the military exercise. If that was if it were the case, why would you make a proposal to begin with, only to cancel it? So it is illogical. And of course, if you think about the previous comments made by Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, he recognized the necessity of U.S. troops' presence in South Korea. And of course, this is an annual exercise. And so I don't really think that was the case.
You think it was more of a pretext?
Even less than that. It's a lame excuse, I should say.
So the number of the issue seems to be, and I alluded in the introduction, is the elimination of the nuclear arsenal in North Korea. Is there some misunderstanding here going on in terms of what the United States expects, or is this an issue of timing in terms of whether or not they decide to get rid of their nuclear arsenal?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think we do really have a high expectation, especially if you listen to our new security advisor, John Bolton. He really does have a sort of mention, right? Not only nuclear weapon, but also biochemical weapons of North Korea and its entire missile system. as a sort of item to be discussed. I'm not so sure Kim Jong-un, when he talked about denuclearization, he had all that items that John Bolton mentioned in his mind. Probably not, I would think. So when they were, even though they're using the same word, denuclearization, it may mean one thing for one, but it may mean another for the other. So there is that issue. And also, even though we can sort of narrow the gap of the definitions to very possibly different definitions, we are not really clear about that yet. It is also a little bit of a timing issue because for North Koreans and North Korean leadership is really crucial to maintain some sort of a bargaining chip. In this case, of course, nuclear weapon. So to give up the nuclear weapon, they have to have a lot and really concrete. Of course, we are demanding that North Korea take a path that is irreversible, right? Verifiable. But I think we should expect to hear same thing from North Korea. They will demand, right? Okay, if we want to take the step, you should take the similar steps that you cannot back away from it. To achieve that, they have to act and we have to take our action to, and then all those actions and should be verified by either side. How do we do that? Well, I don't think it is a really easy to do it all that on either side at once. But of course, that's some people demands here in Washington, D.C. Can we do that at once? All that, you know, recognizing North Korea and building, putting the embassy, get that thing passed by House and Senate. And,
right.
As we know, a little bit about the Congress, how it works. I'm not so sure all those steps that can be done as quickly, well, at once, let alone at once, quickly as North Koreans' satisfaction. So if you think about all those issues, practical issues, I think it's crucial for us to have a really realistic understanding of timeline.
Let me ask you this, because it seems to me that one of the big differences is that John Bolton, as you pointed out, basically says, we've been down this road before. You have to eliminate the nuclear arsenal, and then we're going to lift the sanctions, right? Now, from the North Korean standpoint is that they don't want to eliminate their nuclear weapons until they get a lifting of sanctions, for example. So it seems as if, and I think it was a statement from the North Koreans through the Chinese news agency saying that they wanted something that was synchronous, whatever that may mean. Is there a way to have both those sides come to some kind of agreement, some process by which you would get the ability of the North Koreans, if they so desire anyway, to eliminate those weapons at some gradual case or that would be acceptable to the United States? I mean, are they just simply at odds? I mean, it seems to me that's, you know, one wants it. You know, we want them out before we give you aid, and the other one says, no, we aren't going to, we want the aid before we get rid of our nuclear arsenal.
It is a really practical matter, right? And it's what we have to negotiate. And I think the road is there. And for example, already North Korea is preparing to shut down their nuclear testing site.
Right.
Which means that they are pretty much giving up the future nuclear weapons. So the issue is current nuclear weapons that they have. Is it really going to be easy? I don't think so. John Bolton talked about Libya model, but the Libyan didn't really have a whole lot of weapon per se. And the facility they had was really tiny, small. And some of them, they didn't even open the box, if you will. Our job was really easy, right? Just to bring the package and then brought back to here in the United States. But that is not the case. But can it be done? Yes, I think it can be done. Given the fact that, unlike Libya, where Gaddafi is struggling to maintain power, Kim Jong-un has a total control. So if we can talk really sense to him, if we can satisfy his anxiety and needs, it is certainly doable. And he showed a sign of a willingness to compromise. I mean, if we listen to talk, review the agreements that were signed by both North Korean and South Korean leader, he clearly stated that the denuclearization is his goal. And he even mentioned that that has been the goal of his father, a former dictator, right? But here we also have to be careful, because when he said, when the North Korean leaders pointed out denuclearization, they were talking about denuclearizing entire Korean peninsula, including South Korea. From 2003 and 2009, there was just like a second chance when we talked about the denuclearizing Korean peninsula. Known as a six-party talks initiative. One big hiccup, impediment of the, and of course, eventually the collapse. Major problem was the verification. North Korea, they said they will accept the inspection team. In return, they want to send inspectors to South Korea to make sure South Korea doesn't have nuclear weapons that was deployed by the United States, but known to be removed early 1990s. And if you think about the panics that we had, right, in our society when we heard the news that North Korea had come up with a nuclear weapon, well, of course, they've been living in the panic for the last half century, right? I mean, let's just switch aside. Well, for the record, by the way, I'm from South Korea, not from North Korea. But yeah. If you are in the North, you are surrounded by the southern border is filled with much well-funded South Korean army. And then, of course, this well-funded South Korean army is backed by U.S. forces in South Korea. And, of course, these U.S. forces in South Korea is backed by forces in Guam and Japan. So it's overwhelming force they are confronting. So if you have panic, if you're worried, their worry should be, I don't know, multiplied by like a gigantic number for many, 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 many years. So I think for have a successful negotiation and come to an agreement that we desire, first thing that we have to do is, of course, well, one of the most important things, I think, is to understand their perspective and to try to understand where they come from. And clearly where they come from is the scar of war of 1950 and 1953.
Let me ask about that, because it seems to me, you know, we've had this long period of time, certainly a period of time in which the North Koreans did not have a nuclear arsenal. The United States, South Korea, they've been sitting there. They haven't crossed the DMZ. What makes the leadership now, as opposed to people in terms of the leadership, be that concerned with the idea, or think that there's an idea that the United States or other countries might actually try to invade them or topple them? I mean, is that what makes them think that?
In North Korea, you
mean? Yeah, North Korea. I mean, all the chemists were supposed to have some kind of like sense about the world and how it worked. I mean, they have access to things that certainly the average North Korean doesn't. And yet they seem to have this fear, as you indicate.
The popular answer to that is a propaganda made by the government. If you go to North Korea, you will encounter daily reminder of what happened during the war, which was really tragic, especially for North Koreans. And what we did, according to their view, to threaten their country, including all those annual military exercises with the South Korean troops. So it's a propaganda, but That's they're brainwashed, for example. But
do you think that the leadership itself has basically absorbed this in their own sense of the world? I mean, that they've repeated it so often that
well, my sense is that the propaganda, any propaganda for that matter, works only when there are some truths to it. Otherwise, people will not believe it. And it will be really, really hard to have people believe it for, let's just say, 50 years. Again, if we turn the table, we believe there is a threat coming from North Korea. I really don't think so. But it's widely shared. Are we brainwashed? I don't know. But we believe that, even though, logically speaking, it's far from being correct and valid. So if we think that there is a threat coming from North Korea, if you just ponder the possibility that the idea, that sense of insecurity is maybe not true, well, again, let's go to North Korea. We shouldn't be really surprised, again, when you hear from the when we see North Koreans express their concerns and hatred, because, well, again, as I said, the overwhelming force we have in South Korea, in and of itself, the presence of our forces in East Asia, in and of itself, is a threat enough to North Koreans, who have this really painful collective memories of a war. And of course, now on top of that, right, there are many, many elements, including state propaganda. So I would say the North Koreans do have that sense. And of course, that justifies North Korean dictatorship as long as they have.
Let me ask you this. So it seemed as if Donald Trump got into the presidency. There was an exchange of barbs at one point, the president calling Kim a rocket man and so on. And then all of a sudden, the Olympics come along and there's this dramatic change, it would seem, in the attitude or the view of the North Koreans. They want to sit down. They want to talk. Obviously, Donald Trump took probably the extraordinary action of going ahead and saying, yeah, I'll meet with you, which is something that I cannot imagine, for instance, a President Clinton, for instance, taking him up on. What do you ascribe that change to? Is it just simply that even if you finish your nuclear weapons, then now you're going to, you know, dismantle them? I mean, what is there some internal dynamic going on here inside North Korea, do you think?
When last year or so, I wrote a piece for a Korean newspaper that eventually, soon, United States will not, Washington, D.C., will have no choice but to talk to North Korea now. And why did I make a comment? And I think I was, well, a lot of people were right when they said, including myself. So people ask, what changed? Well, what changed is there's only one thing. North Korea now have weapons that can actually kill, even though the possibilities are really, really small, kill people here in the United States, here in the continent, until very recently, last year for that matter, until they successfully launched the ICBM that can reach Eastern coast, and then
coast, yeah.
Yeah, and then minimize the nuclear warhead small enough to put it in that rocket. The threat always aimed at South Koreans. For Washington, D.C., therefore, they didn't really have a really strong enough of incentive to listen to North Korean and their demand. Of course, it's an annoyance, it's a something important, I guess, from our strategic perspective, but strategic perspective on East Asia, what will happen to Japan, what will happen to Guam, what will happen, how can we deal with China, what will have an impact on that sort of power imbalance in East Asia. But with the technological development of North Korea demonstrated last year, everything changed. Now they can threat us here. That really have to care. We really have to listen. We really have to resolve this issue. And now that need is became really, really urgent. And I think that's the biggest change and most significant change in the whole picture of North Korea. So I think this time will be really, really different, and it should be different.
Because I was just wondering whether or not, you know, initially, certainly within the first year, the Trump administration obviously had all this antagonism. But I was just curious about within North Korea itself and its leadership, and with his new leader, because Kim's still relatively new, whether is there some dynamic inside the North Korean government that decided that okay, this was the moment he was going to change routes in terms of Kim, or can we know?
I think we can have a reasonably good guess. Anything about North Korea is a guess, right?
Right, exactly.
Here is some of the reasons why I have believe that Kim Jong-un could be different. First of all, Kim Jong-un is different from his father and his grandfather. Kim Jong-un was educated in Switzerland, right? He's known to be really, known to like basketball, right? He invited NBA stars, Dennis Rodman. I don't know how many of us remember that name, but so he has that background, and he mentioned that openly that he wants to change North Korea, make people richer, and. I believe it was last year, he actually apologized to the people. He, in the broadcast, it was and broadcasted. He bowed, lowered his head. He said, sorry for these economic troubles, and the party will make sure that people will live in a more, more prosperity. And he could, I guess, the dictator did say that in the party meeting or in a behind the door, but they don't say it in front of the public, right? And recognizing the fallibility of dictator is a big issue. I mean, if you remember when Stalin died, that was an issue, right? Can Stalin be make a mistake, and eventually they recognize well, or Mao Zedong for them.
Right.
But now we have Kim Jong-un, young, but nevertheless brave enough to recognize his mistake. Now, until last year, North Korea has this policy called, roughly translated, double push, right? They wanted to make the country militarily strong, but also make the country economy stronger. And they publicly declared that, and they were pursuing that policy for many years. And last 2 years, when they completed, according to their expression, their nuclear weapon, they sort of declared that, well, now the job is done. Now, among those two push, one is done, right? So what is left? Economic prosperity. So... I think they are moving. They're just moving, as they said, long time ago. I think, again, I could be wrong, but here we have a tendency that we always sort of scrutinize North Koreans much more so than we do, say, other countries, any other countries for that matter, for good reasons, for bad reasons. But if we really look back the whole history, North Korea actually has been quite consistent. They did bad things, right? They started a war, for example. They made a bad policy choices in the early 1990s, were leading to a mass famine. But nevertheless, they have been very consistent. Kim Jong-un, I think, said it, and I think he's doing what he said that he will do, which is making the country strong enough to defend from foreign enemy. Well, of course, South Korean troops and United States.
Let me ask you this. In terms of the economy, some people talk about investment as opposed to, say, aid, which is something quite different. And it's hard for me to imagine corporations investing in North Korea, not down the road upending the kind of insularity that we see in North Korea, and that it could very well lead to an instability of some kind within the country itself. Because when you get these kind of economic changes that occur, not only does the economic change occur, but then you get the flood of these other ideas that come flooding in. The Chinese have been able to sort of manage that over a period of time, moving from Mao Zedong to this capitalist sort of society. How confident do you think would you be that North Koreans could make that same kind of transition? I mean, to leave that control off of the country, because capital is going to be very upending.
Totally. I think that's the reason why Kim Jong-un visited China and visited one of the factories to see, on one hand, to see the development that China has achieved. On the other hand, of course, how Chinese Communist Party have handled. But I heard that North Korea is also looking at Vietnam, because Vietnam is more or less on the similar path, but not same as Chinese model, because China, as we know, now have a huge private sector, and as long as you don't criticize Chinese Communist Party, you can live like any other developed country, right? A Western European country. I think Vietnam and their party, Communist Party of Vietnam, and the government has a much stronger presence in the market. They have a more tighter control. There are signs, there have been signs that North Korea is toying with the idea, toying with this Vietnamese version, where control remain more in the hands of the government than, say, in China. And do I think that is possible? Of course. Going back to China, we have seen this model of success. And let's not also forget that I think we have a sort of really monolithic view on North Korea, that everybody is hungry, everybody is poor, everybody is happy, everybody is just brainwashed. But certainly that is not the case. If you go to, for example, Pyongyang, there are a lot of activities, there are a lot of ideas, and from various sources, we have confirmed that North Koreans have enjoyed South Korean TV dramas and pop music. And so they know what is going on. If they don't know, really, they have some sense. They've been watching all these bright skyscrapers of Seoul and all over South Korea. They know South Koreans live better lives. Well, let me put it that way. They are richer. They know that South Koreans are richer, but they think South Koreans are corrupted. South Koreans are puppets of U.S. imperialists. So you are right. It is upending. So is it possible that North Korea will face this sort of powerful thrive of capitalism and inevitably lose the control over it? But I think they may able to manage long enough to survive politically.
Let me just finally turn to where we are right now. How optimistic are you that that some summit A will come about and that some kind of deal will be struck between the North Koreans and the United States?
I am still cautiously optimistic. As I said, as I believed that we have not a lot of choice left to talk to them, because now they have a nuclear weapon, and war is not an option. I know there have been a lot of people talking about war, this and that, and say this and that. And I think some believe, actually, that war is possible, even limited war or large-scale war. I don't think so, for many reasons, one of which is, well, if we war the option, we would have used it a long time ago. The reason why we haven't invaded North Korea, well, because there is a reason, good reasons, right? I think the negotiation is the only option. Can it be done by Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un in June? That's the question. It's the question of when, not will it or if, right? So I think it will be done. And I think given Donald Trump's reaction to what has happened, I think he's really willing, capable of talking and forging some sort of agreement. When he agreed to meet North Korean leader, the invitation sort of message was delivered by South Korean officials in the White House. And upon the hearing, Trump said yes, despite the fact that his advisors sitting in that Oval Office said, oh, no, right? He just overruled that, all those opposition. So the willingness is there. I think certainly we have seen the willingness on the North Korean side as well. So this is a really hopeful time compared to any other occasions that we have seen so far.
We've been speaking with Taehyun Nam. He's associate professor with political science department here at Salisbury University about the developing situation with North Korea. And we'll see whether or not the summit comes off or not. Appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.
Hi, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. You know, one of the things I love most about food is its power to bring people together, and that food is a gateway to understanding culture. So it's in that spirit that every week we bring you stories and conversations that look at the world food first. That's The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters, from APM, American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 10 on WSCL 89.5 FM.
Hi, this is KT with Delmarva Groove. This is the only show where you can hear new and old music that radio either won't play, or maybe they've just forgotten about it altogether. You can catch us on our new time slot, which is every single Friday night at 9 p.m. And enjoy all the other music programming WSDL has to offer. So tune in and get turned on WSDL 90.7 Rhythm and News.